Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. It's Wednesday evening, May 27th, 2009. And I do this show live every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. I do it on my website, www.europac.net, and on my shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. If you want to call and ask a question or make a comment, the lines are open. We take calls live, unscreened, at 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. First of all, a couple of quick announcements on media. I am going to be, hopefully, if I don't get canceled, on the Glenn Beck Show tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Fox News. I was initially scheduled to do that show on Tuesday, but the president announced his pick, his choice for the Supreme Court. And so I got bumped. But fortunately, they did reschedule. Hopefully, the show will go. This will be the first time I've been on the Glenn Beck Show since I was making regular appearances on his program when he was on Headline News before he moved to Fox. Also, I have a firm date now for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. I will be on that show on June 9th. So that promises to be a very interesting segment. I watch his show from time to time. He's a funny guy. He's got a great sense of humor. And he had Jim Cramer on the show, and he really did a good job of beating him up and beating up on CNBC. So it'll be interesting how he handles me, and if I can hold my own with John when it comes to humor, we'll see. But I'll try my best. What else is going on in the media? Now, I am leaving on a trip on Sunday. I will not be doing the program next Wednesday. Somebody will be doing it for me. I haven't decided who, but I will be out of the country. I'm leaving on Sunday night for a trip to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. I'm speaking at a conference there, so I'll be out of the country, returning on Thursday. And I think this weekend I'm actually speaking at a libertarian rally here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. In fact, just prior to doing this show, I spoke at a charity event, this Irish Shown conference that was extremely well-intended, one of the larger audiences that I spoke in front of. And there were some very, very good speakers there, including David Einhorn, who spoke last, who said a lot of interesting things, particularly about the rating agencies, which is something I've always suspected. And you know, one of the reasons that I'm so convinced that S&P and Moody's will never downgrade U.S. government debt is because of the deal they have with the government, because the government basically sanctions them and requires companies to use their ratings, and other ratings are not considered valid. So it's a real incestuous relationship that they have. And of course, David was mentioning that he was shorting Moody's because he thinks that their ratings are now meaningless, that a AAA rating by Moody's is more harm than good. He says a lot of companies simply abuse their AAA rating because no one bothers to do their own due diligence, and they're simply able to borrow so much money that ultimately they're going to go bankrupt. And one of the other things that he mentioned, which is something I've been talking about for a long time, is the problems of constantly bailing out the creditors, that we have to allow the creditors to go under. And, normally in a bankruptcy, when a company goes bankrupt, the assets of the company passed to the creditors, and the creditors now own the business and operate the company, and the company is recapitalized because it no longer has debt, because the debt turns into equity. Well, that's not happening now because the governments are bailing out the bondholders and dumping the equity on the taxpayers and forcing the taxpayers to operate these insolvent businesses. And this, you know, this is not the way it's supposed to work. But of course, the government is failing to allow free markets to function, and they are going to make this economic collapse a far worse than it needs to be. And it needs to be pretty bad. I mean, again, don't get me wrong. We can't get out of this thing without a major, major economic downturn. I mean, you know, the piper's got to be paid. But unfortunately, the cost is going to be much, much higher because of all the extra tunes that the government is playing that we're going to ultimately get the bill for. You know, talking about what's going on with the government now, and I've been mentioning this on the show, look at the bond market. The bond market has basically been getting clobbered almost every day since the last program. Today was the worst day, yet the yield on the 10-year climbed by a full 200 basis points. The yield went from basically 3.5 to 3.7 in one day. And now if you look at the yield on the 10-year, it's moved up from 3.1 on May 18th. This is on just May 18th, from 3.1 to 3.7. That's a huge move. And the total back up in yields now, since the Fed announced it was going to print money and buy bonds, the day that it did that, the yield on the 10-year got down to 2%. It's now risen to 3.7%. At the rate it's going, I think it can hit 4% by next week. That would double interest rates. Interest rates would double on the year. I mean, this would make probably 2009 already the worst year in history for U.S. Treasuries. And, you know, I think it's very interesting, too, that there are a lot of the people who were getting very bearish on the U.S. stock market who were recommending Treasuries. A lot of people were pounding the table, deflation, get out of assets, you know, buying Treasuries back in October, November, December. That has been the absolute worst trade that you could have possibly made. In fact, if you'd have bought bonds at the end of last year, you're already down 40 or 50% on your money, even if non-leveraged. Sure, you're getting your coupon, but if you have to turn around and sell your bonds, the losses are huge. In fact, I think I remember that one blogger who was criticizing my investment performance and recommending bonds. Actually, anybody who followed his advice and bought bonds is now already down more than my clients already. Because my clients in general who were down 50% when he, you know, at the end of last year, now let's say they're only down 25%, right? But somebody who bought bonds at the end of 2008, they're already down 40 or 50%. They're down as much buying long-term U.S. Treasuries as Euro Pacific Capital clients were buying foreign stocks, commodities, and gold stocks. You know, I mean, it's amazing. And, you know, the losses could get even worse if we start to see interest rates moving higher, which is what I believe that they're going to do. And, of course, this big backup in interest rates is really throwing a monkey wrench into everything the government's trying to do. Of course, how is the Fed going to react to this substantial increase in interest rates? They are going to buy bonds, right? They're going to print more money to try to artificially keep rates from rising, which is a self-perpetuating spiral. Because the more money they print to buy bonds, the less attractive they make bonds because they create more inflation. They debase the dollar. And the more we see this, more people are not going to want their bonds. The Chinese and the Japanese, the rest of the world, the more money we print to buy bonds, the more bonds the world's going to sell, which means the more bonds the Fed has to buy. And it's a self-perpetuating spiral. And I know, you know, I was, you know, getting a mortgage on this place I bought down in Florida. I locked in the rate yesterday. It was taking me a long time. And I locked in 4 7/8. But it's interesting because it took some time to get the paperwork in. But I was surprised that even though rates had backed up dramatically, you know, the rates on the mortgage I was looking at, it maybe moved up from 4 5/8 to 4 7/8. I'm not sure what the rate would be today, but I can tell you that mortgage rates on these Fannie and Freddie mortgages are not rising anywhere nearly as fast as the yields on the treasuries, which is telling me that the government is still providing this subsidy, that Fannie and Freddie are providing mortgage interest rates now that are much lower than what they would have provided prior to the government officially taking them over, which means, and I've, as I've always said, that Fannie and Freddie are acting even more irresponsibly now than they were in the past. And given all the damage that they did before, think of how much more damage they're doing now when they're acting even more irresponsibly, if you could even imagine that, given how irresponsibly they acted in the past. Now, the dollar the last couple of days has kind of hung in there a little bit. We didn't see a resumption and decline of the dollar, although it didn't bounce very much. The dollar index is now, you know, about 80 and a half. It had briefly got below 80. Today, you know, the bonds went down, stocks went down, the Dow was down about 160, 170. But it wasn't a wholesale run out of the U.S. because the dollar did not go down, although the Canadian dollar managed to inch up a little bit as well as the British pound. But it wasn't an across-the-board sell-off in the dollar. Maybe that selling will resume tomorrow or Friday. But I imagine, looking at the chart of the dollar, I think there is another big down leg coming. The bond chart looks horrific. I mean, I think, as I said, we could see big moves up in interest rates. I mean, sometimes when bonds move, they really, really start to move. And the chart really looks bearish for bonds, bullish for yields going up. The stock market, U.S. stocks, still not sure in the short run. They can still go either way, but I think there's still a lot of risk beneath the market. The question is, what's going to happen to foreign stocks if the U.S. market rolls over here? Foreign stocks, again, had a very, very strong week between last Wednesday and today. You know, most days the stocks are going up. You know, one of the stocks that we had, there was a big announcement, a Chinese oil company decided to buy a big stake in this stock. Stock went up 22% in one day. The stock, you know, that particular stock is now triple what it was when people were buying it in October, November last year. Triple. Now, it's still below the peak price that we were paying, but it's an interesting example. I'm going to pull up a chart for that particular stock, and I just use it as an example of of short what can happen in the short run, right? This stock, prior to the big drop in 2008, in early 2008, the stock was at $7 a share in Singapore. And by October of 2008, that very stock was down to $1.77. So if I had a client that bought that stock at $7, right, in early 2008, by October 2008, it had gone from 7 Singapore dollars to less than 2 Singapore dollars. Huge, huge loss. Those were the type of declines that people were, this is what Schiff did. He put these people into these stocks. They lost all this money. Well, where's the stock now? The stock is back over $6. The stock is, what is it, 6.5? I mean, it's almost recovered. You know, it's recovered 90% of the decline. Now, I still haven't sold the stock. And had the stock never dropped, I'd be in exactly the same position as I am today. Had the stock only dropped from $7 to $6.50, how is that any different than going to $1.90 and back to $6.50? It's still at $6.50 today. The main difference is that by going down, it gave people an opportunity to buy more. That's what I did myself. I bought a lot more of the stock personally, and now I'm in much better shape. I owned the stock initially when it was up in a $7 range, personally my own account. But when the stock went down, instead of getting upset and crying about the fact that I bought it too early, I looked at the gift horse. You know, I didn't want to look that gift horse in the mouth, and I took advantage of that stock, and I bought more shares. I bought it from somebody who obviously didn't know what they were doing. They were panicked. They were nervous. They got margin called. Whatever reason, and you know, now obviously it's still not, I don't know where the stock's going to be for sure in a few years. Maybe it'll go back down, but ultimately, if it was a good investment and it was a good purchase, and you know, in a few years the stock is $20 Singapore, right? Again, it doesn't matter that it went down. And the people who didn't buy more, the people who just wrote it out, I guess psychologically it mattered if it caused them to lose some sleep or get nervous. And I feel bad if that was the case, if they're, you know, Euro Pacific Capital clients that didn't necessarily understand the stocks and weren't as comfortable as I was because they didn't have my conviction. but we did our best to try to instill those convictions and make sure that people did the right thing. We didn't have clients who had margin calls, so when the stocks went down, nobody was forced to sell. If anybody sold, it was something that they chose to do on their own. Now, I know that on the way down, let's say the stock goes from $7 to $1.50, there were people who sold at $4. And when they sold at $4, and then when it went down to below $2, they were very happy that they sold. They were very proud that they had sold and had missed and had avoided the additional losses. Well, most of the people who did that never bought the stock back. Most likely, they don't even have their money with me anymore. And so now the stock is back at $6.50. Did they do the right thing by selling at $4? Well, if they had bought it back at $2, then clearly they would have done the right thing. But selling at $4 and then not doing anything and having your money in a money market and now looking at the stock at $6, obviously they didn't do the right thing. They did the right thing by selling, but they failed to do the right thing by buying back. And that is what is so complicated about trying to sell, because you got to be right twice. You got to be right on the sell, and then you got to be right on the buy. Because if you screw up the buy, then it doesn't matter if you got the sell right. It invalidates it. People are better off having rode it all the way down and now having it back at $6.50. Now, ideally, would the person who sold at $4, if they bought back at $2 or $3, would that have been better than riding it down? Well, of course. But how many people could do that? How many people did do that? I don't even think any of my clients did that. So the clients that still own the stock are the clients that wrote it down. And the clients who did ride it down, you know, some of them bought more, you know. And, of course, as I said, there were some stocks. I mentioned the stock last week on the show that went bankrupt. And obviously, you know, when a stock goes bankrupt, I mean, it's never going to come back. Fortunately, you know, that didn't happen with a lot of our stocks. And the fact that it happened with any, you know, is a disappointment. But, you know, it was a major, major a credit contraction that really was very problematic for companies that had a lot of debt. But there are many companies that had debt that managed through this. But there were a few companies that just had too much debt, and they just weren't able to live through the deflation to profit through the inflation. But hopefully we'll make a lot more money on the stocks that survived to more than make up for the few that didn't. And I think the opportunities, because fortunately a lot of those stocks that really got creamed, those are not the stocks that we averaged down in. You know, the stocks like, you know, the stocks that survived, the stocks that didn't have all the debt, but that went down. Because initially everything went down. It didn't really matter. You know, I mean, they sold everything. I mean, there was no reason for this stock to have gone from, you know, $7 down to less than $2. And, you know, and the fact that it was able to move up. But even this stock, even as late as March, you could have bought this stock back at 230 in March. That was a couple of months ago. So you don't know. I mean, when the market starts to move, it starts to move very, very rapidly. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to stay the course in these stocks. And now the question is going to be, you know, if the U.S. market really gets hit, are we going to continue to see these foreign stocks moving up at the pace that they are? Because, you know, I mean, as I said, I'm looking at some of the accounts. As of last night, I think that our accounts are at their high point of the recovery, as of even though the U.S. market was not. And so we'll see. I don't know. But I still think that the initial move, the initial movement out of foreign stocks, out of commodities, into the dollar was the biggest head fake in history. And people who bought dollars, who certainly the ones who bought treasuries, will substantially regret their errors. And I think the people who were patting themselves on the back in late 2008 because they had the foresight to be in treasuries and not to be in stocks, I think, you know, they celebrated way too early, and ultimately they're going to look rather ridiculous for what they did. I wanted to mention a little bit about the Supreme Court nominee, and I know people are talking about it. And you know, the big problem with this whole concept about nominating Supreme Court justices is, you know, the Supreme Court, the justices that sit there are not supposed to interject their opinions, their life histories, their empathy. They're not supposed to, you know, rule based on an agenda, based on their heart, based on, you know, their ideology of what they think on their social agenda is or their economic agenda. They're supposed to enforce the Constitution, even if their ruling ends up, causing hardship on somebody, or even if they don't like the result of the ruling, even if they don't like what happens. You know, but here you have this nominee bragging about the fact that she is going to allow her race, her gender, her personal experience to influence her decisions, and that she's going to make decisions that other justices wouldn't make because they don't have her personal history and background. They didn't grow up in a poor community. They didn't go – but none of this is relevant. We don't want judges to do that. We want to enforce the Constitution. Unfortunately, what we have now is we ignore the Constitution under the guise of interpreting it. But the Constitution doesn't need to be interpreted. It's not written in Chinese. It's very easy to understand. Pick up a copy. It's written in plain English. The only thing that needs to be interpreted are the facts and how the facts apply to the Constitution. But if the Constitution can be interpreted, then that means it's vague, right? And there's a legal principle called void for vagueness. And obviously, if the Constitution needs to be interpreted, it's not even valid. It's not even good law. But the reality is it doesn't. We ignore the Constitution, and here you have Barack Obama bragging about the fact that he's nominating for the Supreme Court a justice who is promising to ignore the Constitution and instead to make law for the bench and decide cases based on how she thinks things ought to be. And unfortunately, she's wrong. I mean, that's the other worst part about it. I mean, obviously, look, if I was sitting on the Supreme Court, I would have a better idea of what would be good economic policy and what decisions would lead to a better economy. But I would know enough not to necessarily interject my opinions. But her opinions are going to be dead wrong about what we need. But the beauty of our Constitution is if the judges simply enforce the Constitution, that is what's best for the economy, because the Constitution keeps the government out of the economy. It limits government power. The government was chained up by the Constitution. The Constitution limits government power, and the Supreme Court is there to make sure the government doesn't usurp power. It doesn't legislate beyond the bounds of the Constitution. That's why they're there. Instead, what you have the Supreme Court doing is validating all the activist things that the government and the judges want to do, and that's exactly what we don't want going on. Anyway, let me go to the phone calls. We got first call up is Ellen calling from New York. Go ahead, Ellen.
Yes. Peter, I have two quick questions. The first question I have is an historical question, which is when Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, I'm curious why the rest of the world put up with that. That's my first question, because I was too young to know what was going on at the time. And my second question is I became a Euro-Pacific customer in December of 08, and I was at your debate last night at the Fordham Law School.
Uh-huh.
And the gentleman who was on the debate panel with you, who represented the Fed, he made a couple of comments about he was worried they were going to have a problem removing the excess liquidity, and he said it a couple of times. And I've heard other Fed governors say, well, we're going to have to remove the excess liquidity. Could you maybe explain in English what they're talking about and how they propose to remove this excess liquidity that they have put out there?
Yeah. Well, first, they haven't proposed anything. They simply allege that they'll be able to do it, which I think is a lie. It's like, you know, somebody is gouging themselves on junk food and they get fat and they say, well, it'll be very easy for me to lose this weight. You know, it isn't easy. And they're not going to be able to remove this liquidity, especially when the economy is dependent on that liquidity. Remember, the reason they injected the liquidity, which means created inflation, is because they wanted to keep interest rates artificially low because the country is so highly leveraged. What they're then saying is, if as a result of all this extra money printing and extra liquidity, eventually we start to see inflation picking up, that now the government's going to get aggressive about raising interest rates to tackle the inflation. Well, how are they going to do that? Because now they're going to pull the rug out from under everybody they were trying to prop up. And if the Fed doesn't have the guts to raise rates now, How are they going to do it in the future when raising rates will create an even bigger problem? So the whole thing is a lie. You know, and he mentioned that in that debate that he was very worried if the balance sheet tripled, but the fact that it doubled, it wasn't as problematic. Well, I mean, the whole thing is nonsense. And right. In your first question, look, I don't know why the world was dumb enough to continue to hold the dollar as the reserve currency, despite the fact that we severed its link to gold. The only reason it became the reserve currency is because it was redeemable in gold. The minute we defaulted, they should have stopped using it.
Right.
What they did is they devalued the dollar. The dollar lost about two-thirds of its value in the 6 years after we left the gold standard, but it continued to serve as the reserve currency in that devalued level until today, and it still serves that way. But that, as I mentioned on this show, is the root cause of the global economic imbalances, and it's the reason that the U.S. economy evolved in such an unsustainable way. Because once we were able to, you know, print money to buy stuff, you know, it's like if an individual had a checking account where they can write as many checks as they wanted and nobody ever cashed them, they can start to live a lifestyle completely inconsistent with what they can actually afford.
Right.
And at some point, when people try to cash those checks and they all start bouncing, then there's going to be a big change in the way that person lives, because once everybody realizes the checks are bouncing, nobody will accept them anymore. And that's the point at which we're at now. The world is starting to realize that we've been writing blank checks. That's why they're not buying as many bonds. That's why you're seeing this drop. That's why the dollar has resumed its descent. And, you know, these trends were interrupted briefly. And I said a lot of people jumped to some erroneous conclusions based on the noise in the market in late 2008. The dollar rose, bonds rose, commodities dropped, and people jumped to long-term conclusions based on short-term market noise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they jumped to the wrong conclusion because they were led astray by that information. They didn't understand the real dynamics of what was going on. And that initial crisis interrupted these trends. These trends are back. Oil got above $63 today for the first time, I don't know, in 6 or 7 months. Mm-hmm. Oil prices have now more than doubled from their low. Commodity prices are rising. OPEC came out today. They said they thought oil prices would hit $75 a barrel by the end of the year. I think they'll hit $75 a barrel by the end of the summer. Mm-hmm. By the end of the year, they could be at $100 a barrel. You know, those trends are going to continue. I think by the end of the year, the dollar index could be under 70. I think that, you know, all of the trends that were in place prior to mid-2008, I think are going to come back only bigger, only with more momentum and power behind them, because everything the government has done since we had these, the financial collapse with Lehman and AIG and all this stuff the government has done to try to prop up the economy has simply worsened the outlook for the economy and strengthened the outlook for commodities and gold and foreign stocks and created even more momentum for the trends that were in motion and that were temporarily interrupted.
Well, I regret the fact that the rest of the world put up with that. My parents were into the gold market in 1970, so I grew up with this. It's not a foreign concept to me, which I find most people today don't know what money is. They just don't know what money is.
Well, I'm trying to educate them.
Excellent job. I really think you're doing an excellent job.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. I need to.
I know you got to go. Okay. Thanks.
But yeah, I mean, a big part of my book, I try to explain the difference between money, which is gold, and money substitutes, and currency, which is what we deal with today. Yes, you mentioned I had this debate. You know, I initially thought it was going to be a debate just one-on-one, me and this former Fed official, but apparently the guy was 82 years old, and I think the organizers were afraid to have an 82-year-old man debate me one-on-one for an hour and a half, and so they decided to make a panel out of it. And so it was two-on-two in more than an outright debate. Oh, I wanted to mention, too, that there's a Time magazine article that was written about me that's coming out in the next issue of Time. It's on the internet right now, and you can read it there, or you can pick up the actual copy. But it was interesting. There was a little bit of a debate going back between, I think, I noticed it on the blogs, between some stuff on Lou Wachwell's blog and Don Luskin, who, you know, could never resist the opportunity to try to, you know, make fun of me. And I don't understand what, you know, the guy's been mad at me ever since I did this TV show with him back in 2007, where he said that the economy was great. You should buy the Dow with both hands at 14,000. That my warnings about an imminent collapse in the real estate market and from subprime were crazy. That, you know, and then he went on his website and said I was the most brain dead perma bear he had ever met. Now, of course, since everything I said has been right and everything he said had been wrong, you think he'd have simply apologized. Instead, he continues to attack me without even acknowledging the fact that, you know, I was the one that was right in that encounter, and he was dead wrong. So basically what he put on his website is he selected, you know, one sentence out of that Time magazine quote to make it look like Time was discrediting me based on the performance of my stocks in 2008, which they weren't doing at all. In fact, Time went on to talk about other things that were much more positive. And there are a lot of positive things in the article, but he just grabbed out of context a sentence that ended in a question mark without showing how the question was answered, because it was answered in a way very favorable to me. But he didn't want to show the question. He just wanted to show the answer. He just wanted to show the question. So, but anyway, the article is on there. You can read it and decide for yourself. But in general, I thought there were more positive things about the article. Plus, it mentioned my book. It mentioned the firm. So for me, in Time Magazine, I think it was good press. Anyway, Dave's on the line in New York. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you loud and clear.
Okay, great. First of all, I'm a big fan. I'm also a Euro-Pacific Capital investor, and I'd like to comment that my stocks have done extremely well over the last few months, and I'm very happy with that. My question is, I have two questions. First of all, about the value-added tax, do you have a preference on whether or not you think that's a good idea?
Well, it all depends. I mean, first of all, I don't want a value-added tax on top of the income tax and on top of the payroll tax. What I would like to see in the United States is we abolish all taxes where it's associated with, you know, with your income. I don't want to tax people for working and saving and investing. I want to tax people when they consume, right? I don't want to tax them when they produce their wealth. I want to tax them when they enjoy their wealth. Not when they're putting into the economic pot, but when they're taking out of the economic pot. And the best way to do that is taxing consumption. In addition, taxing consumption is much simpler because you just buy a product and you pay a tax. You don't have to hire accountants. You don't have to keep books and records. You don't have to risk going to jail if you didn't do it right. You simply buy a product and you pay the tax. And, you know, what I like about the sales tax as well is that it's an indirect tax as opposed to a direct tax, which means it's self-corrective as to abuse. Meaning if the government's going to tax you directly, right, you got to pay the tax. You can't avoid it. But if there's a sales tax or a value-added tax, if you don't buy the product, you don't pay the tax. So what happens is if the government makes the tax too high, it won't collect much revenue because people will simply not buy the products being taxed. So the government, there's a natural limit to how high they can raise taxes because people can easily avoid the tax. I mean, you can't avoid the income tax. I mean, you can quit your job, but people need to eat. They need to live. So they need income. So only really upper-end people. And, you know, that actually does that. I mean, sometimes the income tax on the upper-ended people, a lot of people decide to retire early or not work as hard because of the income tax, because the government is taxing them. In fact, I just read an article, you know, on one of the states that had a millionaire's tax. They imposed it. I think it was Maryland or somebody a few years ago. And now, you know, a third of the millionaires left the state. And some of them, of course, are now no longer millionaires because of the economic downturn. But bottom line is they raised taxes on millionaires, and now they're getting a lot less tax revenue than when the taxes were lower. But I like the way direct excise taxes work. I think they're much less oppressive. Excise taxes are the way our founding fathers envisioned the U.S. government financing itself. They were supposed to run on excise taxes because the government was going to be small. Now, I don't believe that we can abolish the income tax and the payroll tax and have a sales tax or a value-added tax that would collect as much money. There's no way to make it revenue neutral. I don't want it to be revenue neutral. I don't want the government collecting all these taxes. But the only way to go to a small government that doesn't tax us a lot is to dismantle all the spending, to put an end to all the government programs, all the government wealth redistribution. That's what I want to get away from. I want to eliminate that, and I want to pay for the necessary and constitutional functions of government with an excise tax. I prefer a sales tax to a value-added tax because the sales tax is more transparent. The way a value-added tax works is every time somebody along the production chain adds value to a product, they pay a tax. And then when the product finally shows up on the shelf, the price includes all the taxes that have been paid along the way, and you can't differentiate that from the price. What I want is I want American citizens going into a store and seeing how much they're paying and what the tax is. So they know exactly how much they're being taxed, because if it's too much, they can protest it by either not buying the products or throwing the bums out of Congress who passed those high taxes.
Very good. I have one more question. With interest rates right now so low, and you think that the possibility that they're going to shoot up, do you think now is a decent time to buy a house since prices are so low?
Well, look, I don't think it's a good time to buy a house, because I think that housing prices are going to be among the last prices to rise. I think other prices will rise faster and will rise more quickly. There's just a huge glut of supply of houses that's getting bigger and bigger. And I think Americans are going to get poorer and poorer. And houses, the real value of houses, are a function of what people can afford to pay. And poor people who are unemployed and broke and loaded up with debt, they don't have a lot of money to buy houses. And remember, a lot of the demand for housing in the past was artificial, because a lot of houses were bought by people who wanted to make money. They were bought by people who would just assume rent, but they got conned into buying because they believed they would get rich. So that phony demand is going to go away. So, but as far as the debt, you might make money buying a house and locking in a low mortgage. The government is still subsidizing mortgages, and you will make money as a debtor, not as a homeowner. Now, the question is, can you do it with very little down? I know if you can qualify for an FHA government loan, you can do that with a 3% down payment. And if you get an $8,000 tax credit, right? So if I was in a situation where I can get a FHA loan and buy a house that I wanted for 3% down, and then I get a tax credit, which basically gives me my entire down payment back, if you can buy the house for nothing and then lock in a very low fixed rate mortgage, then that might make sense, because you'll end up owning the house for free. But if you have to put a 20 or 30 or 40% down payment, I still think you're going to be worse off. I still think you'd be better off renting and taking that 20 or 30% and investing it in, these foreign stocks, and use the dividends on those stocks to pay your rent. And it's my belief that at the end of the day, you'll have much more wealth in these stocks than you would in U.S. residential real estate.
Right. Any comments on you running for Senate?
I mentioned on the Fox Business the other day, and I saw that there was a lot of, people commenting on it. Liz Claman asked me point blank at the end of my interview, kind of surprised me, asked me if I'm going to run for Senate. And my answer was, I might. And so a lot came out of that. But I also talked to a reporter from The Washington Post, and he called me up. And I told him that, yes, I was strongly considering running, and that I was leaning in that direction. And he asked me what were the odds, and I said, look, I don't know, but I think they're better than 50-50 at this point. So I thought I'm more likely to run than not to run. But hopefully, again, within a couple of weeks, I will have some kind of definitive announcement on whether or not I will be a candidate.
Great. Can I ask one last question real quick? What do you think we should do in relation to China as far as our debt? Do you think we should default on those loans?
Ultimately, I think default is the best option for both the United States and for the Chinese. I don't think we should completely default. I think we should have a restructuring. And I think that would certainly be better off for average American citizens. See, the problem with defaulting through inflation, the problem with printing money and pretending that we pay off the Chinese, is not only do we screw the Chinese, but we screw every American citizen who has dollars in the bank, who has dollars under their mattress, who has a pension, who's expecting a benefit. You know, the worst way to default is through inflation. It's much better to do it honestly, to admit that you can't pay your debts, and to try to find some way to work out a sensible balance. I mean, I think that our creditors are complicit here. I really do believe that foreign governments loaned us too much money. They should have cut us off a long time ago. And for that reason, they deserve to take a hit on those investments. But, you know, I don't think we should pay them nothing. But I do think that we should have some type of way to have a meaningful restructuring and pay back something. And I think if we do that, ultimately, our creditors will be in better shape. You know, it's better if they get 30 cents on the dollar than get all their money back, but the dollar's worth nothing. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Next up, is that Lance in Virginia? Oh, Nick in Minnesota. Go ahead, Nick.
Peter, are you there?
I'm here. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I got a quick question for you. And a Europac client, I opened up an account in October, and I do own that stock you were referring to earlier, and it has done phenomenally well. But I think it also illustrates another important point in that you're seeing these Chinese firms, because one of the reasons, I mean, it had been going steadily up, but one of the reasons it really shot up lately is because I think the largest Chinese petroleum firm is taking a stake in it, and it's kind of maybe showing a trend that you see these Chinese firms going out and
I mean, and what's happened is what they did is there's – and we own both stocks. There's another stock that we own in Singapore that was the largest shareholder in this oil company. And what happens is the Chinese company bought the stake out from that other company. So both of our stocks went up because the company that owned the stake got a bunch of cash. And, of course, they're announcing partnerships with the Chinese company in oil exploration. Look, and we're seeing more of our stocks – you know, where the Chinese are stepping up and buying. You know, some of them, look, there are some stocks that I bought in 2008 that are still way down. They haven't all come back. And even the ones that have come back, few of them have made new highs, but there's a few. I mean, there's probably a half a dozen stocks that have actually made new highs, that have actually recovered what they lost. Now, those are not the stocks that went down 70 or 80%. Those are the stocks that maybe went down 30 or 40%. And some of these stocks have made new highs. I mean, try to find a U.S. stock that has made a 52-week high. But there are stocks in other countries that are making 52-week highs.
Yeah, definitely. Also, would you ever consider the option of custodying the accounts overseas?
Well,
I fear, you know, capital controls and
I've been contacted by a custodian in New Zealand, you know, to talk about probably, you know, can I give my clients the option instead of clearing through Pershing, which is what we do now, to actually clear through a offshore entity so that there are stocks. And I'm still haven't even looked into whether or not the government will even let me do that. I mean, there's a lot of things that the government, you know, it's a very, I work in a very oppressive industry. I mean, believe it or not, the government slows down. There's a lot of things I'd want to do right now, but I have to get permission from the government to do it. Like, you know, I started my research department, you know, 6 months ago. We're covering, you know, over almost 60 stocks, and it's fantastic research. I'm not allowed to share it with anybody. I'm not allowed to send my own clients the research that my analysts are gathering because they haven't approved it yet. And, you know, and there's other things. I'm trying to get approval to hire more brokers, and they haven't given it to me yet. I mean, it's amazing that how much regulation there is. I've got to a point where I can't hire anymore because I've hired so many. And the thing is, I need more. And I've got resumes. I've got brokers. I've got new offices I need to open. But I have to wait till the government gives me permission to do it. I mean, it is insane. It's like you have other brokerage companies that are firing people and are getting billions of dollars in TARP money because they screwed up so badly. And because I've done a good job and my business is expanding, I'm getting new customers, you know, they're putting roadblocks in front of me, preventing me from expanding, preventing me from hiring people who are getting fired, preventing me, you know, it's just crazy.
Yeah, it's absurd. And a quick comment on the first caller who I think she was referring to why the world would accept the dollar. as the reserve currency after Nixon closed the gold window. Now, one of the main reasons behind that, it's an interesting story, has to do with OPEC and their decision to use dollars exclusively in their transactions. For instance,
yeah,
Saudi
that was
Arabia.
part of the problem that the part of the deal is that OPEC decided to denominate oil in dollars. So now instead of the dollar being backed by gold, well, it was backed by oil because you can always get oil for your dollars. And I think the deal we made there with the Saudis was that, you know, you price the oil in dollars and we'll use our military to protect you in the Middle East.
Yeah, there's an ex-NSA agent who wrote a book about it. He was actually part of the deal. His name's John Perkins. I believe the book is called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. But it's an interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly part of it. I mean, that's one of the reasons. And, of course, a lot of, you know, some of the countries that have tried to move away from pricing oil in dollars, such as Saddam Hussein's Iraq, we saw what happened to him.
Yeah, no kidding. And even within OPEC, countries like Iran and Venezuela, there's an agreement where they have to use the dollars in their transactions. But, you know, there's discord amongst the OPEC members.
Look, it's going to go away. I mentioned last week on the show, you know, China and Brazil are talking about bilateral trade in real and RMB and moving away from the dollar. And look, this is going to happen. There's no question. The question is how rapidly it's going to happen. And it's very important that you be prepared. And I think it's going to be an enormous collapse of the dollar. That's the reason that I was willing to ride out the declines of 2008. I mean, I didn't know how big they were going to be, and obviously if I knew in advance, I might have attempted to trade it. But the main concern I always had is, hey, if we sell these stocks because we think they're going to go even lower, are we going to buy them back in time? And is it even possible? Because remember, I don't manage any accounts at Euro Pacific Capital. All the clients make their own decisions. And so in order for me to have gotten my clients to sell, I would have had in 2008, I would have had to call all my customers up one by one. Obviously, I wouldn't do it myself, the reps. And we would have to convince them, hey, we think there's going to be a big short-term drop. You need to go to cash. Now, a lot of clients wouldn't have wanted to do it. What do you mean? I came to you to get out of the dollar. I wanted foreigns. Now you're telling me to buy dollars? So a lot of people might not have done it. How long would it have taken me to convince everybody to sell? I might not have been able to convince them to sell until the stocks had already lost 30 or 40% of their value. And then assuming I was able to convince them to sell, how do I call them all? I'm getting them back and get them all back in. I mean, chances are once I got them out, I might not even be able to get them in. And how long would it take me to call 10 or 15,000 people and convince them to buy back the stocks they just sold? I mean, it would have been an impossible task. It seemed like the easiest thing for me to do was to continue with the program, to ride it out, to invest for the long term and for the way I know it's going to end up. And since I'm confident on the ultimate outcome, the rest is noise. Yeah, and I admit, you know, it's difficult when everybody is yelling at you and everybody's making fun of you and clients are calling up. I mean, you heard the calls on the radio show. People are calling up. They're down. They're upset. People are writing negative things about me on the internet. But you know what? You know, I've dealt with that in the past. You know, I had upset clients in 1997 and 1998 when we had the Asian economic clients collapse. I had a few clients who cashed out, and unfortunately they missed some great years between 2000 and 2008. 2008 was an even rougher year than 1997. We lost a few clients. Fortunately, the vast majority of clients stuck it out. A lot of them added to their positions, and we're still not out of the woods. Who knows, right? Most, you know, very few people have made back all their losses. I mean, obviously, people who started recently didn't, you know, they never had losses. But people who started in 2007, in early to mid 2008, most of those people, if they didn't add money, are still down. Even some of the people who did add money. But, you know, I mean, as I said, we don't have the people, you know, there could be a few exceptions. I don't know, because, again, all the accounts are different. But I know of the clients I've talked to and I looked at, clients whose accounts were down, you know, more than 60%. Most of those accounts are now down, you know, mid-30s. And, you know, and it's still a lot. I mean, I'm saying, hey, I'm not bragging about the fact that, hey, this guy's account is down 30%. I did a great job. He's down 30%. That's still a lot. But, you know, it's not 60%. And, you know, who knows what it's going to be 6 months from now and 6 years from now. And that's really what I'm concerned about, is what these accounts are worth in the long run and what kind of dividend yield can we get in the short run while we're waiting.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the call. I know I'm starting to run out of time and we're Yeah, no, let's skip it till next week because I got a few more people on hold. Let me go to Frank from Oklahoma.
Greetings from Oklahoma Crude.
How you doing, Frank?
Good, thanks. Peter, just to give you a brief history of my investing record, I got out of the stock market entirely in about October of 98 after the Asian crisis, or in the midst of the Asian crisis. I think the Dow was about 8,600. I had a real good 15-year run, and the risk-reward just didn't make sense to me. And then the beginning of this year, I decided to get back in. I felt comfortable with things as a long-term investor, and it just seemed that there was a good opportunity. And I've been an avid listener of your podcast, and I take every opportunity whenever I can see you being interviewed on a show. You just make complete sense to me and my investing strategy. The one thing that was not consistent with my thinking was your support of gold. I think this probably stems from in 1999. I can remember when it was $251 an ounce, and I'm thinking, where does it got to go? It's at, you know, 850, 900. I just don't see how it can go much further. But you have convinced me that it is the way to go. Now my portfolio right now is about 50% in gold, which brings me to my question, because when I was listening on one of your shows, and I can't recall, it must have been maybe February, January of this year, a caller called in and was supportive of your ideas about gold and said he was going to go in full boat and you know, buy gold stock, go 100% gold or something to that effect. And you said, wait a minute. You said, don't do that. Just make it 15, 20% of your portfolio, because what if I'm wrong? And now I don't know where I heard you say this, but I think you had indicated now your portfolio is about 50% gold.
Well, I don't look. It depends on the caller. It depends. Yeah, my portfolio is very heavy in gold. But, you know, I'm, you know, 46 years old. I'm still working. I still have a substantial income. So I have income from working. There are a lot of people who are retired who tell me they want to put all their money in gold. Well, wait a minute. You don't have any income because you're not working. You know, you can't give up all your income and just make one big bet on gold. You need to have some other assets that will pay you yield. And, you know, look, I think, you know, when I was on that Fox show, there was, you know, someone else was saying, well, you should have 5% in gold. I think that's too little. But I think gold is very, very inexpensive right now. I think that given all the things that have happened and all that is going to happen, gold should already be much higher. The fact is people still don't understand what's going on. And in fact, it's interesting because more of the advertisements I see in gold have to do with convincing Americans to sell their gold, not buy gold. I mean, these, you know, you hear about these gold parties like Tupperware parties, and, you know, people are, you know, trying to get their friends to come to their houses so they can buy up their jewelry. And, you know, for 20, 30 cents on the dollar, and sell it to these companies that melt it down. So, you know, instead of buying gold, Americans are selling their gold. Yeah, I mean, they're selling their gold to get cash. They don't realize that their gold is better than cash. Their jewelry is worth more than that paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, but, I think you're doing a great job. I really enjoy listening to you. I think you're able to distill a complicated issues and make it very understandable.
Thanks a lot, Frank, for the call. Anyway,
okay,
I think
thank
I've got
you.
two more callers on hold. I'll try to get to them. Next up, Andrew in New York.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Thanks for taking my call. I'll just be real quick. I know you're almost out of time. For someone like myself who has very little money to invest but is also young, I'd say about $50,000, what would you recommend for the best way to grow and maintain your wealth?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, the best thing is to call, you know, call my office, you know, 800-727-7922 and get a more specific plan. But in general, you know, I would try to buy some of these, you know, good stocks. If you're a young guy, you know, I think you should have some gold stocks. I think you should have some of the Asian stocks. I think the most explosive growth potential is in China. If you've got a long-term time horizon, you got a real long time horizon, you know, you can afford 20 years. You know, can you imagine how wealthy China is going to be, what the standard of living is going to be like in China 20 years from now? Can you imagine how much assets are going to be worth, how much companies are going to be worth, how much real estate is going to be worth in Beijing and Shanghai? I mean, so I would try to take advantage of what's happening. I think you're living in a unique period of history where we're about to see major shifts in asset valuations and standards of living, and fortunes are going to be made and lost. I think a lot more fortunes will be made overseas, and a lot more fortunes will be lost here in America. But you want to make sure that you're, you know, on the winning end of that exchange.
So definitely better to invest abroad than domestic ETFs that are in like gold and oil and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, depending on what they own. I mean, I think you're better off owning foreign assets. You know, you can still own them through ETFs. I mean, I prefer to actually own them. I prefer to buy the stocks and own them myself than some of these vehicles. But it doesn't mean that you can't achieve success with ETFs. But anyway, call up the firm, 800-727-7922, and talk to one of the brokers.
Well, thank you very
thanks
much.
Thanks for your call. And also, by the way, we sent out an email today, an email blast. So if you're in my database, you got this email blast again on the Perth Mint talking about gold, encouraging people who don't own gold to buy it and people who own some to buy some more. I mean, take advantage. I mean, gold is still underneath under 1,000. You know, I don't know how much longer it's going to be below 1,000, but I think once it really starts to move above 1,000, I wouldn't be surprised to see gold moving up $50, $100 a day. And I think when that happens, people are going to be very nervous about buying it. And, you know, I think it's much better to buy it now while it's still kind of calm. Anyway, the last caller is going to be Lance in Virginia. Go ahead, Lance.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Just have a quick question and a quick comment. In your books, I know that you mentioned that you're not an advocate of mutual funds. But I was just thinking, have you ever considered starting your own mutual fund so that, you know, a person that doesn't have a lot of money could invest however much they can into that mutual fund and have some exposure?
Yeah, I mean, my problems with mutual funds have generally been that, you know, you don't necessarily know the people who are managing it and they can make decisions. But yeah, I am in the process. I can't really talk about it because it's not out yet. But I am in the process of launching a mutual fund that will focus on China. And so at some point we will be able to discuss it and it will be available, but there's no information on it now. But sometime, you know, before the end of the year, probably sooner, we will have a product. And that way some of our smaller clients will be able to get better diversification in Chinese names and have access to some of these Chinese stocks that are more difficult to trade. But
okay,
I'll have more confidence in that because I'll be running it, you know, myself.
Yeah, you'll be running it. I think that's good news, and I think a lot of people will be interested in that. I have one comment, because I also think that it's good news when I heard about that you're considering running for Senate, and, you know, I was very excited to hear that. I just have, you know, a few comments, because I know that on a few previous shows you mentioned that, you know, you weren't really that interested because, you know, being a senator, you only have one vote in half of Congress, but, you know, of course, I think the key is that having the vote or being a senator would not be as significant as, you know, what your role would be in terms of having a really, you know, large audience to try to change people's minds in terms of, you know, this road that we're headed down. And you'd be able to have a platform to expose a lot of the,
the main thing for me in thinking about it is just kind of thinking about to see if I could actually win, to see if the America is actually ready to do what's necessary. I mean, to make the right choices, to elect officials that will do the right thing. I mean, if we don't do that, I mean, we're doomed. If we can't change the course that we're on, either by
exactly
changing the politicians or getting the politicians to change what they're doing, if we stay on this course, there is no hope. So
right.
I am hopeful that there will be a change. But I don't know how it's going to come about. So maybe maybe I can help bring that change about better than what I'm doing now. Because certainly I've been talking and talking and talking as a private citizen, as an investment advisor and the owner of a brokerage firm, and nothing that I've said has made one bit of difference on government policy. I hopefully I'm making a difference in the lives of my clients, and I will, but I'm certainly not changing the direction of the country or altering what's happening in Congress. So that would be interesting to see if I can do that. Can I change the direction of the Republican Party? Can I cause, other Republicans potentially, to support me or to vote their conscience or to really try to, put their own political careers aside and try to do what's right for the country. There are very, very few elected officials who do that. I mean, all they care about is getting reelected, and that is the problem. We need people in government who don't want to get reelected, so they'll do the right thing. But anyway, we're running out of time, so thank you for the call. Anyway, that's it. Thanks, everybody, again. I'll be back again. No, I won't be back next week. I'll be back in 2 weeks, but don't forget to tune in. We will have a special episode. Somebody will be guest hosting. Anyway, thanks a lot, everybody. Don't forget to watch me on Glenn Beck tomorrow. So long.